Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. I hope you all had a good weekend. Now, if you thought you had some wild weather-related traffic down here, just wait until you hear about Carmageddon and what happened when a wildfire jumped the I-15 freeway over the weekend. We'll also have news about a lawsuit filed over fracking in California and how that's impacting Latino school children. Then on our Capitol Report, learn about a Supreme Court redistricting decision. Plus, we'll have news for you about a local vote to redistrict El Cajon. On Crime Beat, hear about a local chiropractor arrested for fraud. Plus, learn which East County city may soon be getting 2 4-star hotels and some upscale restaurants. Attitudes toward working mothers are changing across America, but laws to protect working moms still lag behind the rest of the world, and we'll have details. On Jobs Talk, hear about President Obama's plan to expand overtime pay to include a lot more workers, and we'll tell you about the county's plans to cut truancy in public schools. On Green Scene, hear which of our local congressional members got an award for protecting national parks 100% of the time, and which others got 0 ratings for voting to weaken park protections. Our newsmakers today are Michael Moore and Elaine Littleton, 2 Ramona winery owners who will be sharing their concerns about the county's proposed changes to its tiered winery ordinance, changes they say will hurt our region's burgeoning winemaking industry. If you love our local wines, you'll want to stay tuned for this story and much more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with news of a terrifying ordeal experienced by some motorists on Friday. A fast-moving brush fire roared out of control in the Cajon Pass in San Bernardino County, trapping vehicles on the I-15 freeway along the main route from San Diego County to Las Vegas. The North Fire destroyed 2 semi-trucks and 18 other vehicles, damaging 10 more. At least 2 people also suffered minor burns. Motorists tweeted photos as they fled along the side of the freeway in what some have dubbed Carmageddon. Allison Ash with 10 News, an East County Magazine news partner, tweeted, "Insane flames on I-15, firefighters scrambling to save lives." CAL FIRE reported that 5 drones were spotted near firefighting aircraft, and 2 of those drones actively chased firefighting planes. The drones actually delayed airdrops by over half an hour as the pilots took precautions to avoid mid-air collisions. The drones contributed to the fire swelling out of control and destroying vehicles and also homes, according to CAL FIRE. Now, it's illegal to fly a drone close to firefighting aircraft in an active wildfire zone, but so far the owners of the drones have not been identified, nor has the cause of the fire been named. In the Mount Baldy area, an additional 44 vehicles and 3 homes were destroyed by the North Fire, along with outbuildings. Over 200 people remained at an evacuation center overnight. Interstate 15 was shut down in both directions Friday due to the fire, but was reopened Saturday morning. Over 1,000 firefighters and 22 engines battled the fast-moving blaze, along with 6 fixed-wing aircraft, including a DC-10 air tanker. The fire started near I-15 north of State Route 138. Fortunately, rain helped hold the blaze to around 3,800 acres as of Sunday night, though it remained far from contained.
A Kern County family is suing Governor Jerry Brown, claiming that California's new fracking regulations do not protect the health of Latino public school children. The lawsuit filed by the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment argues the new fracking regulations illegally discriminate against Latino public school children who are disproportionately affected by the negative impacts of fracking in their neighborhoods. California law prohibits the state from intentional or unintentional discrimination on the basis of race. The suit, which names Governor Brown and California Oil and Gas Supervisor Stephen Boland as defendants, claims that the state is discriminating against Latino students by permitting wells in close proximity to schools they attend. Fracking in California overwhelmingly occurs close to schools that serve predominantly Latino populations. More than 60% of the 61,612 California children who attend school within 1 mile of a stimulated well are Latino. Statewide, Latino students are over 18% more likely to attend a school within a mile and a half of a stimulated well than non-Latino students. When fracking occurs close to schools, students are exposed to air toxins such as BTEX compounds, VOCs, and hydrogen sulfide that have serious impacts on their physical, social, and emotional health. Rodrigo Romo, the named plaintiff, has two daughters who have been exposed to dangerous levels of toxic pollution and psychological stress from extreme well stimulation while attending public schools in Shafter and Wasco, California. "Every day my daughters go to school, they fear for their health and safety because of how close the fracking wells are to their schools," he says. Sequoia Elementary School, the school both of Romo's daughters attended, is located within a half a mile of three separate fracked wells, with one less than 1,200 feet from the school. Students are often forced to stay inside for long periods of time because of the noxious fumes associated with fracking, and many students suffer from serious, unexplainable illnesses that many families believe are caused by the wells. Madeline Stano, attorney for the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, says, "Fracking and other types of unconventional well stimulation threaten every child's right to a quality education." Stano adds that Governor Brown and state regulatory agencies have failed to protect public school students in California, adopting regulations that shift negative impacts of fracking disproportionately onto Latino students. California's Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources has a mandate to protect the life and health of Californians. Romo v. Brown aims to hold Governor Brown and state regulators accountable for protecting the health and safety of all California students. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Leon Thompson.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is DeVario Bell with the Capitol Report. By a 5-4 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the right of voters to approve an independent redistricting commission. In a case that has implications for California, Justice Anthony Kennedy sided with four liberal justices to uphold Arizona's redistricting plan, approved by the state's voters. The case pitted the Arizona legislature against the public. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, which concluded that banning a voter-approved redistricting commission would be violating the Constitution's principle that the people themselves are the originating source of all the powers of government. He added that while the framers of the Constitution may have not envisioned the modern initiative process, the invention of the initiative was in full harmony with the Constitution's conception of the people as the source of governmental power. Thus, Kennedy reasoned, it would be perverse to interpret the elections clause to exclude lawmaking by the people, especially when that lawmaking is meant to assure that the members of Congress are chosen by the people. Four conservative justices dissented to excluding the legislature from redistricting. They wrote, "No matter how concerned we may be about the partisanship in redistricting, this court has no power to gerrymander the Constitution." If the High Court had ruled against Arizona voters, the case could have overturned California's independent voter commission along with those in 11 other states. Common Cause, a nonprofit group advocating for restoring open government, joined with the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission to wage the legal battle all the way to the nation's highest court. Common Cause National Redistricting Director Cathay Fang hailed the decision as a victory against gerrymandering. In email, she wrote to supporters of the nonprofit organization advocating for citizens' rights. She wrote, "Voters in states across the U.S. have taken a stand against gerrymandering by creating independent citizen commissions that put the public, not politicians, first." Hours after the ruling, Common Cause launched an online petition asking Congress to guarantee fair and independent districting in all 50 states.
El Cajon currently holds at-large elections where everyone in the city votes for all five council races, But last Tuesday, the City Council voted 5-0 to have staff move forward with implementing a shift to individual districts, each electing its own representative. The concept of districts aspires to provide greater representation for minorities to elect representatives reflective of their neighborhood's concerns. Mayor Bill Wells made the motion, stating, "If this is what the people of El Cajon want, we'll go along with it. I think it's important that people understand El Cajon is in no way a racist city. We're comfortable with people having whatever kind of elections they want to have," he said. Councilman Gary Kendrick told East County Magazine that the action was also motivated by concern over potential litigation, since there is a group of attorneys who go up and down the state suing cities with 100,000 people or more to get district elections, he said. "The cities have never won, so we're going to be proactive and save taxpayers a couple $1 million," Kendrick explained. The demographics of El Cajon have shifted dramatically in recent years. Drawing up individual districts could give a stronger voice to the two largest minority groups in El Cajon, Iraqi Chaldeans and Latino voters, who together actually constitute the majority of El Cajon's citizenry. El Cajon currently has one Chaldean woman, Star Bales, serving on the council, but no Latinos. While coincidentally the council has representatives from several different areas of the city, district elections would assure geographic representation for all communities in the city from here forward. As for who would draw up the district lines, which is always a controversial issue in any redistricting proposal, Kendrick said the city would likely contract with a third-party company that specializes in redistricting to avoid a conflict of interest with council members drawing up their own district lines. But Bonnie Price, co-president of the East County Democratic Club, speaking at a club meeting later in the week, said she wants to see a bipartisan citizens commission draw up the new districts to assure that all of the people's voices will be fairly represented. "It worked for California," she says, "and it can work here in El Cajon." The redistricting measure would first go before voters, likely in 2016, and would not be in place until the 2018 elections. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jawan Armstrong with a Crime Beat report. An El Cajon chiropractor, Dr. Mace Richter, has pleaded not guilty to 42 counts related to insurance fraud. According to court documents, Richter allegedly made false claims to insurance companies, and some patients reported that their insurance companies were charged for visits that never happened. Our news partner 10 News broke the news in February, and Richter's lawyer, Gretchen Vaughn Helms, told 10 News her client is innocent until proven guilty. She emphasized this involves allegations over billing and not causing injury or pain to any of his patients. Richter is expected in court next month for trial. The Board of Chiropractor Examiners is reportedly investigating whether to revoke Richter's license.
Currently, the only upscale hotels in East County are located on Native American reservations, but that could soon change. El Cajon's City Council voted Tuesday to move forward on plans to build a Hampton Inn on the site of the former police station on Fletcher Parkway at North Magnolia Avenue near Parkway Plaza. The action comes after last month's approval to bring a Marriott hotel to town. Both are expected to be 4-star rated hotels. The project would also include 2 upscale restaurants. That could include a new eatery created by Cone Restaurants, San Diego's company noted for its many successful startups of unique eateries. The former police station property will be sold for $4 million, also adding funds to the city's coffers. El Cajon recently celebrated its centennial and has been moving forward on numerous revitalization projects, including plans to reopen the East County Performing Arts Center in the city's downtown. Bids recently went out for upgrades to the theater. Councilman Gary Kendrick says revitalization of El Cajon has a snowball effect. "Since approval of the Marriott deal," he told East County Magazine, "our phone has been ringing off the hook from investors who want to build in El Cajon." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The American public's attitude toward working moms is changing. A study by San Diego State University and University of Georgia researchers published in Psychology of Women found that the overwhelming majority of Americans support working mothers. They found that millennials are significantly more accepting of working mothers than previous generations were at the same age. Only 22% of 12th graders in the 2010s believed that a preschool-age child would suffer if their mother worked, down from 34% in the 1990s and 59% in the 1970s. Jean Twenge, a psychology professor at SDSU and lead author of the study, said, quote, "This goes against the popular belief that millennials want to turn back the clock or that they are less supportive of working moms because their own mothers worked. Instead, they are more supportive," unquote. But despite the fact that most mothers with young children are working in the U.S., Twenge says, among industrialized nations, we don't compare very well in terms of the support we give working families for daycare and preschool. The U.S. is among only a handful of nations that do not mandate paid maternity leave, along with Lesotho, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea. Most countries of the world provide at least 3 months of maternity leave for mothers, and many offer some benefits for fathers too, the International Labor Organization reports. Some states have passed family leave measures. California passed a law requiring businesses to give time off to new parents and caregivers 10 years ago, despite objections from the business sector, which predicted such leave would increase costs of business. In fact, evidence points to the contrary. One survey said that almost 90% of California businesses reported no cost increases due to the law. In fact, 43% of businesses in the state reported a cost savings because they were able to hold on to more workers, decreasing training costs and reducing spending on benefits, Huffington Post reports. Companies such as Google have found that increasing paid leave boosts employee retention. Moreover, in New Jersey, women who took paid leave were 40% less likely to get public benefits such as welfare or food stamps, according to a Rutgers study. Despite such progress, only 13% of employers in the U.S. offer paid leave to full-time workers who are parents of young children, according to the most recent data from the Labor Department, and that burden falls hardest on women with low-paying jobs. Another approach to help these working parents is to offer universal preschool for all young children in the nation, a proposal that's backed by Hillary Clinton, bringing the needs of working parents and their children into the limelight on the presidential campaign trail. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy. President Barack Obama has announced that the U.S. Department of Labor will propose extending overtime pay protections to nearly 5 million American workers, including over 400,000 Californians. The proposal would increase the current overtime protection threshold, guaranteeing overtime pay to most salaried workers earning less than $50,440 a year if they work over 40 hours a week. Congresswoman Susan Davis issued a statement supporting the president's action. This move by the Department of Labor will mean more income for hardworking families and the dignity of knowing that their work is valued, said Representative Davis, a Democrat and senior member of the House Committee on Education and the Workforce. We should build on this proposal, she says, and pass a minimum wage increase, equal pay protections, and paid family leave for workers. But the plan has drawn opposition from prominent Republicans who contend that the measure would depress economic growth. Senator Lamar Alexander, a Republican from Tennessee who chairs the Senate's labor panel, has derided the idea as designed to make it as unappealing as possible for companies to create jobs, he says. The salary threshold for overtime pay for American workers has been changed only twice in the last 40 years, and it now covers far fewer workers due to inflation. Currently, only workers making less than $23,660 a year, a wage under the poverty threshold for a family of four, are guaranteed overtime pay. This proposal updates the overtime rules to ensure that millions more Americans who work more than 40 hours a week will receive the overtime pay that they deserve. Specifically, the proposed rule would more than double the threshold at which employers can avoid paying overtime, from the current $455 a week up to $970 a week by next year. That means salaried employees earning less than $50,440 a year would be assured overtime if they work over 40 hours a week, up from the current $23,660 a year. Beginning on July 6th, when the proposed rule appears in the Federal Register, the American public will have 60 days to submit comments on the rule. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Board of Supervisors moved this week to bolster campus safety and reduce truancies at schools in unincorporated parts of the county. The board unanimously approved a recommendation from Chairman Bill Horn and Supervisor Diane Jacob to team up with school districts to post officers from the Sheriff's Department and Probation Department on many campuses. School safety and keeping kids out of trouble are always critical concerns, said Supervisor Jacob. She continued, in this day and age, we need to make sure we're doing all we can to keep our campuses secure. This initiative also aims to reduce truancies and keep our youth off the streets and in the classroom, she said. Sheriff's Department resource officers would be assigned to as many as 23 high schools spread over 10 districts. The county hopes to work with the Ramona Unified, Vista Unified, Fallbrook Union, and Hamul Dulzura Union school districts, along with others. Chairman Horn said, "Our children need a safe learning environment where they know someone is looking out for them. The student resource officers will also help build trust and positive relationships between students and law enforcement." The county also plans to team up with districts to add probation officers to K-8 campuses and other schools to cut truancies. At one time, the county had contracts with 8 districts to provide these officers, but many of the contracts were dropped due to a decline in state funding. The item approved this week gives county staff 90 days to work with the Sheriff's Department and Probation Department to find ways to put officers into the schools. According to Supervisor Jacob and Chairman Horn's formal recommendation, quote, "Given the current economic climate, the time is right to look at reinvigorating these programs to better protect our children and to provide a safer learning environment," unquote. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. When it comes to protecting national parks, the partisan divide between our local congressional representatives is about as wide as the Grand Canyon. 3 of San Diego's congressional members have just been honored with the Friends of the National Parks Award from the nonpartisan National Parks Conservation Association for their contributions to protecting and enhancing America's national parks. Congressional members Susan Davis, Scott Peters, and Juan Vargas all voted to support national parks 100% of the time on bills tracked by the NPCA. California's 2 senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, also scored 100%. All 5 of these legislators are Democrats. By contrast, San Diego's 2 Republican congressmen, Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa, each scored 0%, voting against every single measure to protect national parks that the NPCA tracked in the last congressional session. That included 5 measures that actually passed the House of Representatives, 3 of which were opposed by the NPCA. Measures passed with help from Hunter and Issa include bills to weaken clean water protections and cleanup of water pollution impacting 50% of national parks, severely weaken the President's ability to protect natural and cultural treasures through the Antiquities Act, and remove protections for wildlife on waterways and national parks, including Yellowstone, Grand Teton, and Cape Hatteras Seashore. They also voted against a disaster relief bill to restore hurricane damage to national parks and historic treasures, and against a bill to protect historic battlefields. Congresswoman Davis issued a statement which reads, "I'm truly honored to receive the Friends of the National Parks Award. We have a moral obligation to sustain and preserve our historical landmarks for generations to come." The situation for national parks could get far worse, with some conservatives in Congress currently pushing to dismantle the national park system entirely and revert all public lands to state or local control, meaning some could eventually be sold off for private development, while others might be preserved by local governments. NPCA President and CEO Clark Bunting praised those who received the group's award, noting that in many areas, support for national parks was actually bipartisan, though not here in San Diego's delegation. Bunting stated, "This diverse group of representatives and senators from across the aisle and country used their votes during the 113th Congress to stand up for the natural, scenic, educational, historical, and recreational opportunities that our parks provide." He concludes, "As the national park system's centennial approaches, it's imperative that these champions fight for an increase in park funding, promote land conservation, and reduce the impacts of climate change on national parks."
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we are on the road in Ramona, and we are talking with some people from wineries up in the Ramona region who are expressing their concerns about proposed changes that the county is considering making to its tiered winery ordinance. This ordinance was initially passed with the idea of promoting agriculture and making it easier to open boutique wineries, help small mom-and-pop wineries out. And now the county is proposing some changes, and these folks have some concerns. So my very special guests today are Michael Moore, who is the president of the Ramona Valley Vineyard Association, and he also has a winery himself, the Ramona Ranch Winery. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
In addition, we have Elaine Littleton. Elaine is the co-owner of one of the newest wineries in the valley here, the Hatfield Creek Winery. Elaine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, and welcome to Hatfield Creek.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. So, Michael, on behalf of the Ramona Valley Vineyard Association, what are some of the primary concerns that many of the winemakers and grape growers have?
Some of the proposed changes to the winery ordinance are unbusinesslike and really doesn't make it easier for us to do our jobs in the backcountry. We don't have urban wineries where we can have events, and the events, I think, are one of the biggest issues that we have. Being able to just even have a simple birthday party wouldn't be allowed under the changes to the boutique winery ordinance.
Yeah, it specifically said that you couldn't have any private events, and then even with a public event, it was very confusing, really. It said that you could not advertise anything. If you had a musician play, that you would not be able to, for example, publicize that musician and give them some credit. No advertising. So they really only seem to want background music. You can have a guitarist, maybe non-amplified, come play on an outdoor patio while you have the tasting, but you can't really have an event without going through some very major hurdles.
Yeah, I think their mistake to consider a background musician as an event is wrong. We're just trying to get ambiance music in the background. It shouldn't be that we couldn't advertise it. These people need to make a living, and it also brings people to the wineries, allows us to sell wine, because they're coming up here for an experience, and that adds to the experience coming to a winery with background music.
Yeah, it was interesting at the hearing last week. There was one winemaker who had a different view, and he got up and said, hey, I think just having crackers and no music is fine. And someone else got up and said, you know, this isn't church. It's not communion. And people who are coming for a winery want more than just the wine. They want food. They want music. They want to have some fun.
Yeah, the one thing the county did right was they allow us to have prepackaged food. However, they don't allow us to have any food prepared on site, so that would prohibit food trucks from coming. It also prohibits, I have a friend who has a caterer. Actually, I think he's the one that said it wasn't communion, but he has a pizza oven, mobile pizza oven. He couldn't even prepare the dough and cook the pizza on site. It would have to be pre-cooked, so.
Yeah, it makes it very difficult. At full disclosure, East County Magazine has had events at wineries before, and it is difficult to plan around even the existing rules that they have, and this would make it much more stringent, I would say, very difficult for a nonprofit organization, if not impossible, to ever come up to wineries and bring them business and have events there, which hurts not only the wineries, but it could also hurt the nonprofit organizations that like to have their fundraisers at these wineries.
Yes, the CEP process, I understand, is a little bit arduous. I don't see any wineries applying for that. We're not nonprofits. The nonprofit has to themselves apply for the CEP to come up, do fundraisers.
And CEP, that is?
Community event permit.
Yeah. So. There's also some kind of entertainment permit, and I know your winery ran into some problems where there was a complaint about noise, and yet your neighbors all say they didn't complain. So who do you think did?
It wasn't actually a noise complaint. It was a complaint that we were having live music without an entertainer's license. So we were contacted by the sheriff's department. They said that we needed an entertainer's license. We said we would apply for it. They sent us the paperwork. And in the meantime, the sheriff called the county PDS, and PDS would not allow us to have the permit or the license because we were not zoned for the license. We were zoned ag. However, the boutique winery ordinance is a zoning ordinance, and it does specifically say that we can have unamplified music.
Yeah, so there's conflicting language in the ordinances there. On the one hand, you've got the boutique winery ordinance saying, yes, by right, you can have at least non-amplified music. And then you've got the sheriff coming out and saying, no, you got to apply for an entertainment permit. And then the zoning folks saying, well, but you can't get that because you're zoned ag and agricultural zoning. We don't allow entertainment permits. So it's a catch-22 situation.
Right. So there's some miscommunication between zoning and the sheriff's department, however that works.
Mm-hmm. Another issue I understand was the size of the winery facilities and the size of the outdoor patios and some of that. Tell us what some of the concerns are there.
Well, I think our biggest concern is the size of the building and the gallons we're allowed to produce. They really don't match up very well because in order to serve the public and have several years' worth of product on hand, you cannot store that all in a 5,000 square foot building for a winery. You have to minimum about 10,000 square feet. So we need to revisit that with the county and figure out if there's some way that we can alter those numbers and what their reasoning was on only allowing 5,000 square foot buildings.
I know you've said, and others have testified too, that even though the ordinance has minimum amounts that you're actually allowed by right to produce, that they're not allowing enough square footage to make that even possible with the amount of space that would be needed, you know, per gallon to store the wine, to age the wine, to store the harvesting equipment and everything else that's needed.
I think that's the biggest thing is the harvest equipment, the stuff that we use one time a year, can't really store that in the winery. It takes up a lot of space, so we definitely need that other space to be able to store that. And like I said, a couple years worth of product, all the equipment to make it, and all the bulk wine that's being aged, it doesn't all fit in a 5,000 square foot building.
Yeah, interesting. Elaine, now you're one of the newest winery owners here, and obviously it takes a lot of years to grow enough grapes. I know that another issue in this winery ordinance that some people have objected to is the fact that up until now, the county has not allowed any grapes to be used other than from one's own winery. The county is now saying, I think you can have 25% from another winery, but none from outside of the region. And you've raised some concerns about that, I understand.
Well, what the original tiered winery ordinance proposed was 25% of the grapes had to be grown on our property, which is fine because it's designed to be a farming ordinance and to encourage farming in the county. 50% of the grapes grown have to come from somewhere else within the county. Mm-hmm. And then 25% of the grapes can come from anywhere, like Riverside County or Mexico even. What we had asked for after the first workshop and the first revisions were looked at was to also to be able to do transfers of bulk wine within those same percentages. Still growing 25% on our own property, still getting 50% of our grapes from elsewhere in the county, but that last 25% to be in the form of either grapes or the equivalent in bulk wine. And the reason for that is that there's a lot of us that have such small production facilities, we don't have any white winemaking equipment, which takes up a lot of room and it costs quite a lot of money and we're already pretty heavily invested in everything else.
Yeah, and San Diego is known primarily as a red wine region. There are a few that are doing a good job with white wines, but the wine is being made here, but many of the white wine grapes are being grown elsewhere where the climate is more ideal for that. So how big a problem is that if people come in here and they say, hey, I want a Chardonnay or something and you don't have one?
Well, yes, it's a problem because you really need to have a white wine on your tasting bar because there's always the oddball who thinks they don't like red wine. And also a rosé is optimal to have on the tasting bar too. Where all of us who make wine are also very concerned and interested in the wine and food pairing aspects because wine is meant to be consumed with food. And so you've got food pairings that you're doing. Some of them obviously require white and rosé wines. It is a whole different process. Well, and here's the other thing is that the ordinance, the way it was constructed, it didn't address the wine transfer issue. And now they were trying to close that hole so that no wine could be transferred. Now we've got a winemaker up the road. He's retiring. He's turned 80, and it's all aspects of the wine growing, production, and sales were just getting too much for him. So he had a whole lot of wine he'd produced. He would have been sitting there with that, trying to wholesale it to restaurants somewhere to get rid of it, instead of being able to just transfer it to another winery half a mile away. Still a farming ordinance. The grapes were still produced locally. The wine was made locally. But the ordinance that was proposed would have closed that door and that opportunity.
The other problem with saying you can not have any wine from outside the area, as someone pointed out at the hearing last week, is that when you have a natural disaster or other catastrophe, whether it's a major pest infestation or as happened in Napa when they had the big earthquake, what kept those wineries going is they had to go and buy grapes from outside of the area for a while because obviously, you know, they had all their bottles shattered and so forth. Here, I could certainly foresee something, a major wildfire, for example, like the Cedar Fire that did burn a lot of the vineyards.
Well, one of the very early original versions of the tiered winery ordinance had a provision in it for starting up wineries and for natural disasters, in that a certain percentage of wine could then be transferred in under those conditions. That whole provision was removed.
Why? Do we have any idea?
I have no idea. We weren't involved with the process way back then. But again, a growth period, because it's not like craft breweries who can decide they're going to have a brewery open in December and it's now June and they can get a space and equipment and the product made and be selling it in 6 months.
Yeah, how many years does it take to age the wine from the time you plant the grapes until you can produce your first bottle of red wine?
Well, at least 6 to 8 years minimum, depending on how long you're going to age your wines. We planted in 07 and then started harvesting our grapes and making the wine in 2010. And didn't get our tasting room open until 2012 because there's an aging of the wine that needs to go on. So it's a lot of outgo with no income. And then when you are opening your tasting bar with the young wine, because now you're really anxious to get some income coming, it may not be the optimal time to be actually pouring that wine. Maybe it needed another year, but you just didn't have another year to give it because you needed to start marketing it. So,
do we have some inkling of why the county is doing this? They say the ordinance was supposed to help the small vineyards, and I mean, in some ways it has. The original ordinance, as Supervisor Jacob has said, and she pushed forward the original ordinance, when she first put it forward, there was one tasting room in Ramona, and now there are 30 of them, and even more if we go down the 94 corridor and up in Julian and some other places. So why do they seem to want to sort of kill the goose that laid the golden egg here? What is the reason why they're looking at all these different restrictions?
Well, I don't know. You're asking a couple of entrepreneurs here who think like small business people and farmers to try to figure out how government staff and politicians think.
Mike, I know you told me before that the three major winery associations locally were not invited to the table, that you didn't hear about this until there was an announcement of a hearing. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, that was one of the biggest concerns that we had, and the reason that we contacted Joe Ferracci at the county, just because we weren't involved, and basically we were all brand new to this after the original boutique winery ordinance passed. We all started our wineries after that. And so we were going by the rules and regulations of the boutique winery ordinance. And then all of a sudden they decide they're going to amend the boutique winery ordinance without even talking to the stakeholders, which were the wineries that had opened after the ordinance. So we were very surprised by that.
Now there were some complaints, a dozen or so, and I believe they were made anonymously. Do we know what was behind that?
I think Elaine was chomping at the bit to answer that one.
Elaine?
Again, you're trying to have us think like other people, but I was one of the 13, and we were turned into county code enforcement on 4 different accusations of violation.
What were they?
That we were running a bed and breakfast. Now, we have a one-bedroom, 1,120-square-foot house with one tiny bathroom, period. So the allegations that were levied at us specifically and most of the others generally
were all completely fictitious. The other, we were accused of having an illegal tasting room. Well, that was about 6 or 8 months before we'd even opened our tasting room. So it wasn't legal or illegal or otherwise.
We covered your tasting room and everything seemed to be right above board.
We were accused of preparing food on site. Well, that they pulled that off of my website because as small farmers at harvest, one of the attractions to get people to come help you harvest is that you do a harvest breakfast for them after they've worked their tail off in your vineyard for a couple of hours.
Seems to make sense.
So that's, yes, I prepared food on site for my harvest people. I make quiche and muffins and cut up fruit, mm-hmm. and that is all perfectly legal. It's been going on for hundreds of years on farms. So all of the accusations that were made were completely false. After that first workshop, when these changes were proposed, and there were 100 people in that room, more than 100 people, not this last workshop we just had, but the first one a year or so ago, I called Joe Faraci at the county, and I said, okay, I said, were you a little startled at the passion of the 100 people in that room that didn't like what was going on? And he said, well, yeah, I was. And I said, would you please let me put together a group of the leaders from the main organizations, and can we meet with staff and do a round table and have the seat at the table that we'd been begging for before that.
What did he say?
And he said, yes, please. Yes, please. I think he was just totally shell-shocked mm-hmm. that the small group he had been working with weren't representing the majority.
So it sounds like, did these complaints originate from the public, or did these complaints originate from some competitor where maybe it's just sour grapes? They're worried about the competition.
Exactly. What you just said. We've all been scratching our heads trying to figure it out, and that's the only thing we can think of, is that some of us who are upstarts and mm-hmm. the later ones really have knowledge of marketing and know how to work it. Some of the others that were here earlier are very passionate about grape growing and wine making, but getting it to the public seems to be of less, either of mm-hmm. less concern, or they're not knowledgeable like a lot of the rest of us are.
Now, in all fairness, I did talk after the meeting with Mike Mangini from Mangini Winery and Julian. They've been around a lot of years. He does do major events. He was one of the only wineries in the county. There was only a handful. I think you can count them on one hand that actually had a major use permit before this tiered winery ordinance came along. But back in the day, he told me it cost $25,000 when he got his major use permit. And today it's maybe
$250,000,
$250,000, so 10 times larger. His comment to me was, hey, these new wineries, they're just trying to do what you need a major use permit for without getting the major use permit. What would your response be to that?
Well, I think we would all like to do more than we're allowed to do under the boutique winery ordinance. I think a lot of us probably don't want to do as much as we're allowed to do under a major use permit, but somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. But it's all a matter of dollars and cents. None of us have $250,000 to invest in a major use permit. In fact, if you ask me, why are the Ramona wineries only open on weekends?
Why are they?
Because everybody has day jobs down the hill, Monday to Friday, to support this little infant enterprise.
Yeah.
There's no way in God's green earth mm-hmm. are they going to come up with $250,000.
And frankly, today with $250,000, Mike Mangini or Mr. Schwazdale, some of the early ones in that got these permits when it was only, you know, $8,000, $25,000, depending
right.
what year they got it, they might not be able to afford it today.
Oh, no.
Either. Mike, I understand that a poll was taken of some of the association members asking them if these new proposed rules were in effect today, would you still open a winery? What were the responses you got?
I think we got an overwhelming response of no. It's too restrictive at this point and cost prohibitive to open a winery. I would gladly go back and pay $25,000 for a major use permit if that was possible. You could pay for that with 5 weddings. I mean, it's simply that easy. So the fact that anybody with a major use permit can have weddings, they can have concerts, they can have other things that we don't do at a boutique mm-hmm. winery, that is the reason to get a major use permit. I'd rather stay small and intimate and have background music and a little bit of food and sell my wine and just be happy.
Why are the major use permits so expensive? I probably should ask the county that, but I'm sure you have. What's the supposed justification for it being $250,000 to get an MUP?
Well, I think last I heard from somebody working on a major use permit, it's $170,000 to $250,000. There's environmental studies that they have to do. Every site is certainly specific, and it's not necessarily guaranteed if you pay that $250,000 that you're going to get a major use permit. It is not guaranteed. So that's a lot of, it's discretionary. So
maybe nobody will ever go for it again.
Exactly.
Huh?
You know, I mean, they could find that you need a stoplight in front of your property and there's no way you could ever pay for that. So.
Elaine, I see you're just itching to get in here.
Well, one of the issues regarding that area is that economic development is the creation of jobs and the prosperity of the residents of whatever region the staff and the elected representatives are governing. The county of San Diego has no economic development department. They have not one person on staff at any level that has any background in economic development. So economic development in the cities and the counties that do have those departments and do have that knowledge of what it takes to develop an economy in the region know that you have to cut fees. You have to phase in some other fees after the building is built and after the employees are in and after the business is starting to make a profit, then they can start to phase in some other fees.
Yeah.
Sales tax revenues. You get a business up and running so that it's generating sales tax revenues. That's where the county then starts to reap the rewards of economic development. And instead of killing it with huge fees, even before anybody gets to open their doors, better they should have an understanding of economic development and phase in fees if that's what they want, or eliminate them and just let sales tax replace their $250,000.
Yeah, instead of the major use permit fee up front, get it in the sales tax for years and years down the road. I know that during the hearing, not only the winery owners, but the president of the Ramona Chamber of Commerce, for example, spoke to how much the wine industry has already revitalized Ramona, that before this ordinance was passed, it was really blighted. You had a lot of businesses, you know, that had closed up downtown, tourists weren't coming here, and this is bringing tourists to the area, he said, not just for the wineries, but it's helping the restaurants and the shops on Main Street and so forth.
Well, yes. And when the county announced that they were having another workshop, the one that you and I, we all attended here a week or two mm-hmm. ago, and they sent the invitation out to what they refer to as stakeholders, their original concept of stakeholders and the people who were originally invited to the first workshop mm-hmm. were the grape growers and the winemakers. I let them know and put the word out about the workshop that their stakeholders have now multiplied enormously.
True.
Which is why the chamber was there representing all sorts of businesses. The caterers were there.
Musicians
were there. The stakeholders who are looking to the wine industry to help put food on their tables now are stakeholders. But again, I'm really concerned that the county doesn't understand that whole concept.
Yeah. What is the status on this now, and what is the next step? If people want to weigh in who are listening to this with public comments, Mike, how can the public weigh in? How long does the public comment period extend?
I think it's open for a while for public comment. Anybody who has input can contact the county and email them their concerns or their wants and needs. Then it's going to go I guess back to review, and then they'll put out a draft again for us to go to public review and weigh in again and then see where it goes from there. I don't know if we're going to be involved in any more stakeholder meetings.
One bunch of stakeholders that's been kind of left out of this is the public that likes to come wine tasting and visit the wineries, and I don't think has there been any effort by the county to reach out and hear what the public wants, what kind of experiences they would like to have that would bring them out to the wineries or keep them from coming to the wineries?
Yeah, I don't think they've actually put it out to the general public yet, mostly just the stakeholders. And so That would be a really good idea. Ask the public, general public, what they'd like to see of the wineries in the backcountry of San Diego County.
Well, there will be a process when it goes to the Planning Commission. Those are public meetings, and they'll be publicly noticed. And then heaven knows how many people all the wineries will get to those hearings at the Planning Commission. And then after it leaves the Planning Commission, it'll go to a publicly noticed meeting that the public can attend of the Board of Supervisors. But I will say that after, as we left that last workshop a week or so ago, the staff was pretty anxious to hear from people, the people who hadn't spoken during the workshop, and then other people after the workshop were encouraged to email them their comments, not just comments, but with suggested wording of what they would like to see put in the ordinance. So it's still a very fluid document by the sound of it.
I want to be fair here, too, to the staff. I know they've worked very hard on this.
Oh, they have.
Are there some areas where they have improved things? Are there any areas where, you know, the staff has worked with the industry so far to make any changes, you know, to improve it?
A little bit. But one of the speakers at that workshop quoted an historian or Mark Twain or somebody who said, regulators need to understand the business that they're trying to regulate before they can do it properly. So for one of the things that we'd asked for in one of our workshops, roundtables with staff, was that the vans that were allowed to bring groups were limited to 12 people. I had talked to the Grape Line Shuttle that operates in the valley north of us and in other wine regions, actually, around California, and they don't run anything as small as 12. And about 21 passengers was what they, the smallest that they knew of that they would run or that any of their competitors were run. Now, none of us want a Greyhound bus coming into our little boutique wineries. Mm-hmm. That would just swallow us up. So they changed it to a 15-passenger van from 12. Well, nobody runs 15-passenger
really
vans
helps.
Either. So they threw out little bones, but
it's not enough to help.
Not enough. And, you know, one of the big areas of confusion, and I did a follow-up email to staff, and on the topic of events that Mike talked about earlier, what is an event? We're allowed to do promotional things that help us sell wine.
Okay.
But a lot of the promotional things that we do to help sell wine, other people are calling events. Like we have a wine club. Mm-hmm. And when we have our quarterly wine club pickup party and we have a musician playing and we have a caterer bring in some food and our wine club members are treated generally at no charge when they come to pick up their, a lot of people are calling that an event.
Yeah, and
it's how we sell our wine.
As media, I find it very frustrating, this rule over when can an event be publicized and when can't it. I'm on the mailing list for a lot of wineries. I've gone there, visited, interviewed, bought wine, even belonged to a couple of wine clubs. And when I get an invitation in about, hey, you know, we're having these wonderful events with food tasting or music or whatever, I don't even know sometimes am I allowed to put this one up on my calendar for my readers to know about or not. I know my readers like knowing about it. They love hearing about the wine events, but these rules about not publicizing it to me seem very extreme. I would like to know, how do other wine growing regions handle this? How do the rules in San Diego compare to Temecula, Napa, Paso Robles? I'd love both of you to weigh in on that, you know, to the degree that you're familiar with that.
I'm not sure we can adequately address that question. San Diego was one of the first wine growing and winemaking regions in the state of California before Napa, before the other regions. And we're the last in. And I'm sorry, but I think I have to go back to my tirade on economic development. I really do. The others figured out what a tourism boon it was, what a sales tax generator it was, and they've made allowances.
I know a few years ago we were told that, at the time, Temecula, you could open up a tasting room for about $5,000 and that down here it cost about $100,000 with all the permits and this and that. So there does seem to be some disparities between the rules in the different counties. And certainly, having traveled through the other wine regions, there seemed to be an awful lot of events and music and so forth everywhere at the wineries.
there. But Mike, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
No, we've looked at a few when we were going in to talk to the county and to see what regulations are in place for other counties. But I think San Diego is one of the most restrictive so far. You know, if they don't want us to have weddings and they don't want us to have concerts, then say no weddings, no concerts. Why is a birthday party or a musician playing an acoustic guitar considered an event? So, you know, I don't understand that reasoning behind it. But, you know, Temecula has about a 30-year jump on us. We're in our first couple of years of a new boutique winery ordinance. I think as long as we just keep working with the county, we'll get to where we need to be. You know, they have given us a few things that we've talked about in the meetings, but, you know, I think there's room for improvement.
Well, I know one thing everyone agrees on, that there's some awfully good wines being produced here. Supervisor Jacob mentioned that there's a lot of local wines being produced that are better than the big T, as she called it, Temecula. Tell us about some of the awards that have been coming out of these Ramona wineries lately, which is a federal appellation as a wine region now.
As winemakers in Ramona, we enter a lot of contests. So we're trying to figure out if we're growing the right varietals and competing against other wine regions as far as quality is concerned. And we have a surprising number of awards at the same contest that all these other wineries in Napa, Sonoma, Lodi, Paso, Santa Barbara, they all enter the same contest we do, and we always place in the same rankings as them. So we're doing pretty well.
Yeah, I know we've had some around that have won even some international awards, beat out Napa, beat the French in one case. So they're definitely coming along.
Yeah, I actually said before that you couldn't grow Pinot Noir in San Diego. However, we just had one of our local winemakers with a locally grown Pinot Noir win double gold at the Finger Lakes International Wine Competition. So we can grow Pinot in San Diego.
Very nice. That's impressive. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us here today, and I'd like to give each of you the last word, any parting thoughts that you have that you would like our listeners to know.
Well, I think anybody out there who hasn't visited any of the wineries in San Diego County in the backcountry definitely need to check us out. Quality wines. Don't forget about the wineries, urban wineries in San Diego County as well.
Elaine?
And then anybody who has any concerns about what they've heard today or have any ideas on what they would like their winery experience to be at the little wineries, and we're pretty proud of being little ma-pa operations. Our visitors always say it's really a joy to be able to talk to the owner or talk to the winemaker. So if you've got any concerns about our potential for success and your continued enjoyment of us, please contact the county, Heather Lingseller or Joe Faraci, and I'm pretty sure that Miriam will have that up on a website or something.
We will. If you go to eastcountymagazine.org and you go to my food and wine section, we will put a story up about this with a link to this interview, and we will put links up to how you can submit your comments to the county so that your voice can be heard as well on this very important issue. I want to thank both of you, Elaine and Michael, for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much, and come back.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, thank you for having us on today and voicing our concerns with the Boutique Winery Ordinance reorg.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.